Sister Naima.
Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, we'll talk after the show starts. I gotta get it.
Okay.
Women have the power to transform this world. We can end crime and violence if we all agree to do one thing. Share. Let's share our wisdom, share our time, share our talents, share our finances. But most of all, let's share our love. This is the Female Solution. Join me, Naima Latif, every morning, 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Central Standard Time, as we bring you stimulating discussions about the issues affecting our lives. If you're listening online at www.blogtalkradio.com/the-female-solution, press the blue button that says follow and get our daily topics every morning directly to your email and your smartphone. Call in with your comments, 347-539-5639, and be a part of the solution.
Good morning, and thank you for listening to The Female Solution. I'm your host, Naima Latif, and greetings to all my family listening around the world, because we are all one human family, and I love you all, those I know and those I have not yet met. So, to my family in China, Sao An, in India, Subrabhat, in Japan, Ohayo gozaimasu, in Korea, Jo Enachim, in Russia, Dobre Utra, in Germany, Guten Tag, in France, and all the French-speaking people around the world, Bonjour, in Spain, and all the Spanish-speaking people around the world, Buenos Dias, in Egypt, Sabah El Khair, in Ghana, Maache, in Nigeria, Ekaro, in South Africa, Sanibonani, in Senegal, Jam Ingafanani, in Kenya, and all the Swahili-speaking people around the world, Habari za Sabui, in Israel, Boker Tov, in Saudi Arabia, and all the Arabic-speaking people listening around the world, Assalamu alaikum. Good morning, and may peace be upon you all.
When it comes to the criminal justice system, as many community activists have stated, putting people in jail is just big business, an extension of the U.S. slave system, largely African-American with a sprinkling of Hispanics and poor whites, designed to incarcerate those who cannot afford to pay for good legal help. What happens if you're falsely accused and your defender insists that you plea bargain, even if you're innocent? Some men have endured the injustice of the criminal justice system by having to become legal experts themselves in order to mount their own case. Well, today we're going to hear from one of those who has had the horrific experience of being forced into plea bargaining, and we're going to talk a bit about that the rest of this week, because there's a group of lawyers and legal experts who are working at changing the system of forcing people into false confessions in order to perhaps improve the political appearance of some of the people in the criminal justice system. Well, today we're going to welcome to our show a very courageous man who has overcome a very horrific experience and has gone on to triumph and is himself a communicator, TV talk show host, and one who is exposing some of the good things that happen in the society despite his bad experience. I want to welcome to our show Mr. Leon Loving, host of the television show My Guests Ain't Guessing. Good morning, Mr. Loving. Good to see you this morning. Thanks for joining us on
Good
The
morning.
Female Solution.
Good morning. Good morning, Naima Latif. Good morning to your listeners. Glad to be here. Okay. So what do you want to start at?
Well, you know, when you told me that story, it brought tears to my eyes. And the other day, as a matter of fact, last week, we taped a hearing. It was a special meeting conducted by some lawyers who are investigating the large number of African Americans that are convicted each year many of them who are not guilty of anything other than just not having the money to pay for a lawyer who will do the right kinds of research. But can you just give us the background of what happened to you? And then when we go to a commercial break, we'll get a chance to let our listeners kind of give you a little bit of feedback and perhaps find out how something this horrible can happen to someone who is innocent. So can you start at the beginning and just tell us what happened?
Okay, back in, I think it was June of 1983, I experienced a nervous breakdown in Chicago, on the streets of Chicago, sort of. And I was over a friend's house. I, you know, started experiencing, like, strange symptoms. I got up, left, walked over to the Dan Ryan L, wrote the L to the end of the line. I took it from 69th to the end of the line, 95th, and I went and used the public phone to call my then-wife, my ex-wife, and she told me, Leon, you should come home right away. Okay, I looked up and saw that the 112 Vincennes bus had just left, pulled off. So it's about 1 o'clock at night. So I decided that I would walk over to Halsted Street. As I walked to Halsted, was walking to Halsted, people's front lawns appeared as cemetery plots to me, you know, with the flowers and everything. Also, my symptoms after I was finally taken to the hospital was that I was highly confused and highly disoriented. So as I was walking down the street, I couldn't figure out north, east, west from south. I would walk, say, a block or half a block, and I would stop because I was so confused and had my directions mixed up and what have you. And mind you, I used to live on 95th and Wentworth, so I knew the area very well. So continuing on, I walked around aimlessly for about 3 hours, 3 to 4 hours, trying to find Halsted. Finally made it to Halsted. When I got to Halsted, bus did not come. So I decided I would walk over to my uncle's house, who lived on 99th and Low. And as I was walking, I got more confused. It was around 98th and something that I was there, and I was looking out the corner of my eye, you know, peripheral vision, and I saw the police sitting there. They were watching me, you know, walking in this confused state of mind. So finally they approached me and said, asked me where I'd been for the previous hours, and I tried to explain to them and asked them what was wrong, and they said there had been an armed robbery committed close proximity to where we were. And so they told me to get into the car because I didn't have an alibi. So they put me into the car, they took me about 2 or 3 blocks away from there to a secluded area near 98th and Eggleston. At this area, it was near some railroad tracks, and they had, you know, the landscape of the grass is almost like 5 feet tall. They started questioning me again. They played what's called the Mutt and Jeff game. The Mutt and Jeff game, for those who don't know, the Mutt and Jeff game is where one officer pretends that he's the good guy and the other officer pretends are the bad guys. So what they did was, you know, this particular officer said, you know, played that he was the good guy and he was there to help me. And he told me that the other guys were, you know, sad and, you know, they don't want to help me. They're going to do this and that to me. So I'm in the back of the car, handcuffed, back of the squad car, handcuffed. I'm shaking like a leaf because I'm experiencing a nervous breakdown, which, by the way, doesn't occur in a couple of minutes or something. It happens over a long period of time, and it's also called a psychotic episode. Okay, the police, it was two squad cars of them. It was about 6 to 8. I know it's at least two squad cars. It was about 6 to 8 big, burly, white police. They took turns, getting in on the passenger side of the front seat, interrogating me. In fact, one of the police asked me, did I have any money? He asked me for money because what was stolen that night. By the way, the couple, there was an armed robbery at their home. No, it's at their lounge. They owned the lounge. I don't know when this was, the robbery took place, but what was taken was the money box with the night receipt and a couple of some jewelry. So, they asked me, did I have any money? And, if I gave them some money, they would let me go, because all that the couple wanted was their money back. So they would let me say money, and they would let me go. But I didn't fall for that. So, once again, as I said, they took turns getting in and out the car, interrogating me. Finally, one of the officers got in the car, the front seat, pointed and stuck his service revolver to my head, to the temple, and said, confess.
Oh,
he clicked the trigger and said, confess. So I confessed to this armed robbery, which I didn't commit. And that's called an act of appropriation, I think that's what it's called. But, it would be the same as if you were in an airplane and someone was going to hijackers, and you give in to their demands. You give in to save lives. So I gave in and confessed to save my own life.
Oh, wow. That's scary. And that very common thing, people having to confess at gunpoint in the face of torture and all other kinds of things, that really frightens me, just realizing that these policemen are still out there. But now, tell us what happened. How did your family find out where you were, you never made it home, right? So tell us what happened after that.
Continuing on, I was taken, no, they took me to the couple's house, about a couple of blocks from there. I'm sitting in the back of the squad car. The couple's house was kind of set back from the street. The man came up to the car, squad car, and he's cursing me out, you little black nigger, get your ass out the car. I'm going to kick your ass. And, the police are standing there just laughing, having a great time because, this black guy is going to kick this other black guy's butt. And, he didn't get me, but, and also, they asked the lady, does he look like the man? Of course, she said, yeah. They didn't have any, there wasn't any lights on. She couldn't see me. But she said yes, because probably they had, gave her advance that they were bringing a suspect back to their house. So they took me to police station, what's that, on 111th, that police station. I was locked up there. I called my mother, I believe. Yeah, I called my mother, and there began my journey. I went from 111th to 51st and some other police station. I was, they transferred me back and forth, for about 2 days. And finally, I was taken to Cook County Jail. My family had found an attorney for me. Someone had referred the attorney to them. Finally, my brother and my aunt, I came to Cook County, and he had paid my bail money, bond money, to bond me out. But I was terribly disheveled, terribly disheveled because I had, you know, had experienced this nervous breakdown or psychotic episode, and had not had any treatment.
And nobody recognized any physical symptoms or anything?
No, no one did. No one. None of the police. No one. I recall I gave away. I had a jacket and a shirt that day. And one of the prisoners, I recall giving my shirt to him because something he didn't have, so I gave him my shirt. My brother took me home. Well, took me over to my mother's house. And I'm going to cut through the chain. So began my experience. I went back and forth for 2 years to court. First, it started out at on 26 in California. Then it was moved out to Markham. Went to Markham back and forth for about a year, 2 years or year and a half there. Now, also, my profession is human resources. I'm a human resources professional. I have many years working in human resources management administration. Granted, I do not know law per se, but I do, working in human resources, know labor law. Whenever I would go down to my attorney's office and ask him how the case was going and, you know, various things, you know, what was he doing in terms of my case, he wouldn't talk to me. However, I observed one thing, that he did love the gangbangers, the drug dealers. He would just eat them up, you know, he'd play with them, and, you know, he'd just bosom buddies with them. Me, because I would go to his office in my three-piece suits and my briefcase, I was a black professional. He was a white, you know, attorney. He definitely did not like me and would not, you know, cooperate. Yet I'm paying this man. Okay.
Wow.
So anyway,
you know, that's one of the things that's really upsetting.
Wait,
you know, because we know a lot of public defenders have to do a job, but when you're paying somebody, they don't do the job, that's really frustrating. Well, we're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, I'd like you to take us through the whole situation of what happened in court and how you ultimately ended up having to serve time despite being innocent.
Yeah.
And I'm going to ask our callers. We're going to have a little technical situation. So what I need for you all to do is press 1 now so that you can be part of the conversation, those who want to ask questions between now and 10 minutes to 8. I want you to be able to speak. And so while we work on our switchboard, I'll need you to already be in queue. Great. Okay, so we've got Brother L.A. on the line, and we want to bring you in. And Brother Pianchi, and Brother Mark, and Mama A.Z., just need you to press 1 now so that we can be a part of the conversation, and there you go. And let's see, got my sister on the line here also, all right, and there you go, Brother Pianchi, and all right, and we've got our sister Rashida on the line as well. Okay, so we're going to go to a commercial break. When we come back, we'll go further into what happened to the court, and of course, those who have questions, just chime right in, and Brother Pianchi, what I'm going to ask you to do, because my phone might lose a signal, if you can just moderate the conversation for the next 30 minutes, just in case I lose the signal, I'd appreciate that. And this is a fascinating story because it's happening to a whole lot of us across the country. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more with Leon Loving, who is host of the television show My Guests Ain't Guessing. And he's definitely not guessing about the injustice in the criminal justice system. I'm your host, Naima Lateef. We'll be right back with more after this quick break, so stay with us.
What happens when a group of people are kidnapped from their homes, smuggled away in chains, and held captive in a foreign land where they are tortured, raped, and forced to perform hard labor by the lash of a whip and under the constant threat of death? Slavery, the African-American psychic trauma. What happened to the doctors, writers, scientists, builders, educators, and spiritual leaders from Africa's golden age? Who did they really capture and sell into slavery? Are all African Americans suffering from psychic trauma because of a conspiracy to hide their true identities? Do you have psychic trauma? Take the test on page 22 of the book and see. Order it online today at www.naimalatif.com. That's www.naimalatif.com. And get your personally autographed copy of the book, Slavery, the African American Psychic Trauma.
Mr. Loving?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, could you go, we're back from our break, could you go into more detail, please?
Okay, sure. Okay. As I mentioned, went back and forth for 2 years going to trial. The trial was moved from 26 in California out to Markham, the court out there. In June of 1985, it finally came to trial. Can't recall the exact day, but it's in June. I was to be in court. I think my trial was supposed to start about, I think, 11 or 12 noon, something like that, or 1 o'clock, something like that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I arrived at court about 9 o'clock in the morning. The judge asked me, he said, Loving, where's your attorney? I said, I don't know where my attorney is. He's supposed to be in court here. He says, well, Loving, go call your attorney. I go call my attorney's office, and his secretary tells me he's en route route to the courthouse. And I said, okay. So I go back, and I tell the judge what the secretary told me, that he's en route to the court. 10 o'clock rolls around. 10 o'clock rolls around. Still no attorney. Once again, the judge tells me, Loving, go call your attorney. I call the attorney once again, attorney's office. Once again, the secretary tells me he's en route. 11 o'clock rolls around. Still no attorney. I call secretary once again, tells me that this time, his secretary tells me that my attorney had the Denver boot put on his car, and he had it towed. Okay, I go in and tell the judge this story. Okay, 12 o'clock rolls around. 12 o'clock rolls around. The judge says, attorney hasn't showed up yet. 12 o'clock rolls around. The judge says, Loving, go have your lunch. We're going to have this trial with or without your attorney. So I go downstairs in the basement and to the cafeteria and have my lunch. You know, he tells me, you know, now the thing is, you can have a trial without the defendant being present. That's called in absentia. However,
yeah,
you can't have a trial without, you know, your attorney being there.
Right.
So I'm sitting there downstairs in the basement, having my little, you know, tuna and soup for lunch. And guess who comes and sits beside me?
Your attorney?
No, it wasn't my attorney. It was the arresting officer and the lady who falsely accused me of robbing her. Now, had I really robbed this lady, and if she could really remember me, Do you think she would come and sit right beside me?
No.
No. No. She nor the arresting officer didn't even recognize me. They couldn't remember me and probably wouldn't know at that time, after 2 years, couldn't remember me from Adam's house cat. So I finish my little lunch, and I go back upstairs to the courtroom. When I go to the courtroom, by this time my attorney has showed up. So I'm looking around the court, and it's like that little cartoon that used to appear, I think, in the Tribune or the Sun-Times. What's wrong with this picture? Can you figure out what's missing from this picture? So
yeah.
I'm standing there, and you know, something's wrong with this picture. Something's not right here. So what had happened was my attorney didn't have his briefcase. The briefcase was in the car, you know, remember, that had been towed. You know, the police his car had been towed because they had the Denver boot on it. So my attorney, he's going to play the role of the Great White Hope, and he's going to defend me without, you know, the information that's in his briefcase. So I, as always, have my briefcase with me. I had to give my attorney paper. I gave him a notepad to record the trial notes on, and something else I had to give him. He had to borrow medical reports from the state's attorney, as well as something else, some other things from the state's attorney. So the trial starts. I chose and elected to take a bench trial, which later I found out that was a big, huge mistake, taking a bench trial as opposed to a trial by jury. My reasoning for taking a bench trial was I felt that I had three strikes against me already. I had three strikes against me. A, I was black. Number two, the case dealt with mental illness. And thirdly, I was accused of a Class X felony. So that's
Loving,
yes, ma'am. Yes.
Just for the listening audience's information, I don't know what, I've never heard the term bench trial. Could you explain that a little bit and then go on?
Oh, sure. A bench trial, you do not have a trial by jury. A bench trial is when your case is decided by the judge only. The judge hears and listens, and he makes the decision, as opposed to having a jury, and they make the decision.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay. Okay, so the trial starts, and, you know, somehow the judge, he denies all of my attorney's motions. Everything that my attorney says, all the motions and whatever, he denied everything. Now, keep in mind that during my arrest, they found no gun on me. Also, they did not administer the Miranda Act, the Miranda rights to me. However, they lied in court and said they did give me my Miranda rights. So the whole thing, the whole trial was really messed up. I recall saying something to to the judge, which would have set a precedent. He denied me that when I mentioned that in court, you know, because I stood up and he said, sit down. And I didn't sit down because I said that, you know, all of the attorneys in court always get the chance to stand up. They don't have to sit down. So I stood up, and he was saying, and he seemed to get scared of something and said, well, I don't know what you're talking about. You better talk to your attorney, because it was that, what I said, I can't recall exactly what it was, but it was that profound. Anyway, to make a long story short, I was fine. He found me guilty, you know. As I say, there was no evidence, there was no preponderance of evidence to say that I was guilty, you know. There was no gun found. All that they had was a forced confession. Okay. So found guilty. I go back to Cook County Jail, and I stayed there for 2 weeks. Come time for the sentencing trial was in 2 weeks. I come back to Markham Courthouse for the sentencing trial. While I'm locked up, my attorney comes to me and he says, "Well, I'm going to tell the judge this, that, and other, and he's not going to listen to me, but I'm going to tell him anyway." And I say, "Okay, okay, okay." So he runs his little spiel. We were in court at the sentencing trial. He gives the judge his little spiel. State's attorney, they give the judge their spiel. Now, the state originally was asking for 10 years, from the judge. So after they both said their little spiel, I raised my hand and I said, "Judge, can I say something?" And he said, "Sure, Loving, what do you want to say?" Now, during the trial, the state had said, because I have a degree in psychology, that I fake my nervous breakdown. So I raised my hand and said, "Judge, because I have a degree in psychology, I did not fake my nervous breakdown." And that would be the same as to say, if a doctor, an MD, were to have a stroke of the brain, they would say that he was faking his stroke of the brain. So the judge gave me, broke it down, and he gave me 7 years. He said 7 years rather than 10 years. So when I went back to, you know, the Cook County Jail after the trial, all of the inmates were telling me, you know, because, you know, I told them what had happened. They said that, you know, I should have kept on talking because, and that, you know, I did better, far better for myself than what my attorney had did for me. Mm. So anyway, yeah, so I went back to Cook County Jail, and I was sentenced 7 years. I can't recall how long I had to stay in Cook County Jail. But anyway, I was sent to Dixon Correctional Center up near Rockford, Illinois. Dixon is a medium security outfit, mm-hmm. medium security institution, which has, excuse me, you know, it has, I called it a combination country club. It looked like a country club and a college campus because, you know, we stayed in dorms. I had my own room with a key to it. You know, it was like dormitory style living. I had mm-hmm. one floor. I had my own room with a key to the door. It had a bathroom in my room, as well as a desk. The institution had lots of green grass. It had a tennis court, a handball court, a track field, a softball court. So it was, you know, not that I'm bragging anything, but it was, you know, rather nice. It was, as I say, it was a medium security institution. And nothing like what you see on TV all the time and the way
yeah.
prisons are portrayed on TV.
Right.
At the time I was there, this is back in 1985 when I was went. There were only, I think, about 9 prisons in Illinois. At that time, we had, as I call him, the great law and order governor of Illinois, Governor James Thompson was the governor. I served, in actuality, 3.5 years because you do half of your sentence. It was probably a little less than that after I got all of my good time. I think I got about 3 months good time. By the time I got out, I think there were about 23 or 21 prisons that had been opened up in the state of Illinois.
Wow.
Anyway, go ahead.
To complete 7 years? Or
no, no, no. 3.5. You do half of your sentence. Back then you did half of your sentence. So I did 3.5 years. Is that
standard kind of set procedure?
That you do half?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I don't know if that's still in effect now, but I'm pretty sure it still is pretty much so. Okay. So at that time, you either had to get a job or go to school. And also, I think you were paid $15 a month, you know, as they call it, slave labor, to either go to school or get a job, you know. Little jobs that they had were pretty much, you know, janitor or something like that, or some were fortunate to light duty to work in the prison library. You know, there were some pretty nice jobs, you know, as jobs go. But, you know, I think most of the jobs only paid $15 a month. I went to school and subsequently earned my associate's degree in business and information systems. But I, you know, would like to add, once again, that not brag or anything, but it wasn't totally a bad situation. As I say, it was a cross between a country club and a college campus. And also the fact was, you know, it was a medium security. And also, if they're called correctional centers, if, you know, and they're portrayed, all that you see portrayed on TV and what have you was the maximum security prisons, Menard, Statesville, and Pontiac. That's all you ever see.
Okay.
Once again, not bragging or anything. But if they, you know, correctional centers are prisons, was really that bad, do you really think that guys would be going back 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times? No. You know, as guys always brag, you know, they can do their bit. And that's why they go back 5, 6, 7, 8 times, because, you know, it's not totally a bad situation.
Well, Mr. Loving, I have a question, and I'm going to open it up to the rest of our listeners. And by the way, my name is Rashida. I'm from St. Louis. So it seemed like the judge from the beginning was hostile, and as your trial went on, it seemed like, you know, he was very close to, like you say, he was closed in emotions that your attorney made, and pretty much seemed like he had made up his mind what he was going to do, that you were guilty. And I'm also sure that many black people, especially poor black people that have to encounter the legal system, the court system, experience this. Just amazing how little they had, as far as they didn't seem like they had any evidence at all, other than, like you said,
none whatsoever.
They had the forced confession.
Right.
And they lied about giving you your Miranda rights, and they found no gun. So it's a travesty, and I'm sure many black people, especially poor black people, have encountered this. Well, I'm going to, you know, open up to, you know, anybody else. Brother Bianchi, did you have any questions or anyone else that's listening?
Let me make one additional statement
about that trial.
As I mentioned, my attorney was prejudiced. He was a racist, in my opinion. He's prejudiced against me because I was a professional black man. You know, as I said, I went to his office in my three-piece suit,
yes,
briefcase, And, you know, being a professional, I talk professionally also. That disturbed him. You know, and as I said, he ate up the gangbangers and the drug dealers and what have you. He also, the judge in this case, also was black. So he, as far as I was concerned, he was prejudiced against the judge also in that the trial, you know, we went back and forth to court for 2 years out in Markham. He never did show up on time for this particular judge's, whenever we had had to appear in court. He never did appear on time, if he showed up at all. Most of the time, I went before the judge and had to speak for myself. But all of the white judges, he was on time and showed up to their courtrooms. So I think, you know, probably the judge, you know, let me have it because he was mad with my attorney, as you kind of like alluded to. You know, I suffered the consequences for my attorney's prejudice and racism and disrespect of the judge, who also was black.
I see. Oh, okay. Mm.
And I also found out after I went to prison that the judge, he was nicknamed the Hanging Judge of Markham, so that perhaps had a played a role in it also. He didn't, you know, he was a very strict judge and did not offer lenience to defendants. Okay, so I'm open for questions.
Okay. Well, Brother Bianchi, anybody else?
Yeah, this is Bianchi here in St. Louis, Mr. Loving. I'm sorry to hear about Mr. Bianchi.
Okay.
But, you know, it sounds like this happened. You know, Cook County Prosecutor Office was brought up on a story that was appeared in the Chicago Tribune around the early 90s, mid-90s, I guess. I don't know the exact date. Mm-hmm. But it appeared in a running series beginning that Monday of a particular month, and it was called Trial and Error.
Okay.
And it was called Part 2, The Flip Side of a Fair Trial. And it had many situations in there where people was locked up. I think they even told a story where a young man was at a basketball game, and the game was televised, and you could see him there in the stands. And he got convicted of a crime he didn't do, even though that type of evidence was produced. But in the Cook County Prosecutor Office, as a reporter reported later on, that they had a event going on there which was famously labeled Nigger by the Pound.
Mm-hmm.
And what they would do, it was an ongoing competition amongst the prosecutors to be the first to convict defendants who weight totaled 4,000 pounds. Mm-hmm. And it said men and women went, upon conviction, was marched into the room and weighed, and of course, whichever prosecutor totaled up 4,000 pounds of convicted men or women would win that contest. So I'm not saying that you might have been caught up in that also, but
perhaps
you probably was. Yes, I'm sure.
Even then also. Once again, I did not have a public defender. I had a paid attorney.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But, yes, that does happen because, you know, as we say, the prison system now, legal system, it's called the new slavery. You know, it's industrial or whatever, slavery. And people are sent to jails and prisons because... it's big business. You know, prisons are owned by private industries, private companies and what have you. So, as they say, it's big business, they get so much money for incarcerating men. And, of course, you know, the percentage of black men being incarcerated in comparison to Caucasians, Hispanics, and what have you is it's disproportionate.
Did they weigh you at any point? Because in their stories talking about the courthouses in Markham and Rolling Meadows, how they used to call Markham Darkham, and they called Rolling Meadows Rolling Ghettos there on 26th Street.
I'm quite sure I was weighed while I was at Cook County. I'm pretty sure I was weighed there. But, you
okay.
know, you're right. In terms of that, but I used to be assistant director of personnel at Dawson Technical Institute in Chicago. Dawson Technical Institute is part of the City Colleges of Chicago. In my role there as assistant director of personnel, I was close friends with the director of security, who happened to be a policeman, high-ranking policeman. He was like director of, narcotics. This individual subsequently went on to become chief of police for the city of Chicago. He hired as security officers many Chicago police. These police, you know, I started at 8:30 in the morning. I would get to work at about 7 a.m. in the morning, and I would listen to these police telling there was no shame in their game. They would tell of their escapades the night before, how they robbed, raped women, stole things, things that they did, you know, all the crimes that they committed. And I have long maintained that many people get on the police force simply because, you know, they have alternative modes, simply because as a police, you are in a unique position to commit crimes and be able to cover up the crimes. You know what I mean?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so, you know, yes, ma'am.
I have a question. This is the
sure,
city.
Sure.
What,
okay.
After your experience, and I'm sure you probably did research and came across, you know, information or whatever, what recourse do people have in that instance where they feel that they have inadequate legal representation? And,
okay.
I don't know what happens when you were paying for your attorney to defend you.
Mm-hmm.
And what about specifically poor people who, you know, they're given representation? You know, what recourse, if any, do they have? And I'm guessing there should be something out there that anybody could do, you know, if they feel that their attorney is not doing the best job for them in representing them.
Okay, here's what happened. Here's what one of the recourse that you have. You can file a complaint with the attorney's disciplinary committee. However, that's a total farce. It's a total farce. Excuse me. Because I filed the complaint. However, they sent me a letter back saying they found, no problems, nothing was wrong. My attorney he met all of the requirements and did this, that, and other. And, you know, they found nothing wrong with his representation. And as well as, you know, my attorney sent me back a letter, too, while I was incarcerated, saying that I can't recall him having a brain freeze at the moment. He didn't think he did anything wrong, and he was, I can't think of the word, but he's offended that I would file such a complaint.
Well, he couldn't have been too honest of a guy if he had his car sold for not paying his parking tickets or whatever.
Right. And certainly he, as I said, the whole thing was, the whole attorney's disciplinary committee is a farce. I don't think, I forgot what the record is, but I don't think maybe once in maybe 10 years they may actually take some action against, if they ever did, against an attorney. They also have the same thing for judges, judge disciplinary committee. That's a farce also. You know, it's a kind of an old boy system. Also, you can file an appeal. I filed an appeal, which was denied also by a the judge that heard my appeal. He denied it, you know, after all the evidence was presented, the fact that no gun was found, and they did not give me my Miranda rights. The judge that heard the appeal, he was a well-known black judge in Illinois. So that I exhausted, you know, I used that recourse. So the only thing I was left with was to file a, give me a second. It's called, where you write a statement before, and it goes before the governor and the prison review board. And I'm having a difficult time thinking right now. But anyway, that was nice. Denied also.
Wow.
That was denied, so I had exhausted everything.
So is that, that mean that you pretty much, if though you go the recommended chain of command, however you want to say that, to complaint, and it's denied at every level like yours was, you pretty much
wrong.
Is that what you say? You pretty much on your own?
Yeah, I'm on my own. I can't do anything else.
Okay. That's so unfair, you know, because when you have a legitimate complaint like that, and, you know, these that are in authority over the attorneys and the judges, they're not there to witness what's happening, you know, in the courtroom, you know, what is transpiring between you and your attorney. You know, they are not privy to all of that, and they make this kind of distant decision, you know. And
right.
You're like, hey, I know what's going on. I'm here at ground zero, and I see what's happening. You know, hey. So, you know, and again, that's just another travesty, you know, in with our court system, especially for court people who really don't have anything to fight against, you know, other than the truth. You know, so I was just curious, because I really don't have experience with the court system, and was just wondering what's out there that somebody could do if they were found themselves in the same predicament, you know, as far as having an adequate legal representation.
Does anybody have any other questions? Because, you know, it's called the Just Us System, J-U-S-T-U-S, Just Us System.
Yes.
You know, as Richard Pryor used to joke, if you go there, get into the system, and you're looking for justice, you ain't going to find nothing but just us, you know.
Wow. Well, Mr. Loving, can you share with us what kind of, and I'm sure it was great, what kind of impact that whole experience made on you, your life, you know, how did it affect your family?
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, sir. I was just wondering how.
Okay, I can say this. During my incarceration, I did attempt suicide. I attempted suicide. However, as you can tell, it was a failed suicide. When I did attempt the suicide, I was sent from Dixon Correctional Center down to Menard. I think I stayed in Menard for about, I think about 6 months, and was ultimately brought back to Dixon to finish out my sentence. You know, as I said, I did get my associate's degree. After I got out, I was very leery of police. Certainly, probably to this day. And as I tell everybody, now, first off, when I told the story, what happened to me that night that I was arrested and had the gun stuffed to my head and forced to confess to an armed robbery I didn't commit, people would be in awe. What? The Chicago police did that to you? And I would say, yeah, the Chicago police. Do not be fooled by what's on the side of their car, where it says, we serve and protect. What that actually means is we serve and protect our own selfish interests. That's all it
means.
Not that we serve and protect the interests of the people and we protect the citizen. We serve and protect our own selfish interests. That's why they, you know, arrested me falsely, stuck the gun to my head, and also during that whole ordeal, they asked me for money. The police asked me for money. You know, it came down there, you know, trying to get me to bribe them into letting me go. Or, you know, had I, you know, gave them money, which I didn't have any, you know, it would have been stuck in my pocket. They could have subsequently, ultimately shot me out, still shot me or whatever. But, you know, it was for their own selfish gain.
Well, I must say, Leon, you definitely put some realism into the reality of us versus the police. Well, I want to say thank you to my dear co-host, Sister Rashida Rafat from St. Louis. You did a fantastic job. I know who to call when I need to go on vacation. Thank all of you all so much. Because I had to step away from the switchboard and take my grandson Adam to school this morning. I knew I'd lose the signal at a certain point because I had a little technical difficulty with my phone. So thank you all for carrying on. And I was able to hear, and, you know, it's scary because these policemen are still out there. Now, Leon, I know that you know, you're kind of going through some breathing things. I know you've got to take some oxygen. But I don't know, are you able to stay with us for a little longer, for the next, another half hour,
yes,
or do you need to kind of rest a while? Can you stay? Great. Okay, well, you know.
Yes.
Take a swig of oxygen.
Let me just make one. Yeah, let me make one more comment. You know, I was saying that police, they serve and protect their own selfish interests, you know, despite what it says on the side of their car, police cars, their squad cars. Also, you know, and when I told people, they would say, were in awe, oh, the Chicago police did that to you? Well, you know how it is. The incident that we had the time we were coming home, the studio, we were stopped, man. You, Naima.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and I mentioned, you remember? And, you know, I mentioned to you then that it appears to me, and I'm quite sure a lot of people see it also this way, that part of the requirement to be on the police force, and I'm just, you know, exaggerating to a degree, but it's really true, is that you can't see. It seems like the police... The requirement is that you have to be blind in one eye and can't see out the other eye because so often they shoot innocent citizens because they mistaken, you know, a cell phone for a gun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they mistake different things, saying they will shoot a citizen, innocent person, saying they mistake, you know, whatever they have for a gun. I just recently, I think it was last week, saw on the internet where police, I forget, I think it was in California somewhere, a person was sick or something, But he had a bag on the side, you know, so that his he had a problem, and that his urine would flow into this sack. And they saw this big sack, I guess, under his clothing, and they shot him.
Oh, my.
Saying he had a large bulge in his clothing. So, you know, later when questioned about the shooting, the police, their answer was, well, I'm not a medical doctor.
Mm.
You know, isn't that sad?
That's horrifying. Yes.
Loving,
well,
I'm surprised they didn't plant a gun on you. I'm really
yes.
Yeah, right, and they also do that trick. They plant guns on people. They didn't plant a gun on me, as I said. They never found any gun. No gun was ever mentioned.
Mm, mm.
I mean, except for that whoever did it used a gun to rob the people. But no gun was ever found.
Well, you know, that means we really have to look at those.
No gun was presented during the trial. Total miscarriage of justice.
Yes. Well, we're going to take a quick break and give you a chance to kind of catch your breath a little bit. When we come back, I'd like to get perhaps some names, if you remember, the judges involved, and then what are some of the possible legal steps? I know that when they coerce you into confessing, that makes it difficult to sue later on, and that's one of the difficulties that a lot of people are facing right now. They've had to confess to the crime, and then when they want to go back and say that they were falsely accused, the records show they confess. So that's kind of how they get you. Like you say, you know, they serve and protect their own interests. But we want to
right.
see what are the ways we can possibly identify who those people are that were involved, and then what are some possible legal recourses to those who are forced into a false confession. You definitely have a story to tell, and it needs to be a book and a movie. But we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Yes, sir. But thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for staying with us a little while longer.
Sure.
And we want to, of course, involve the rest of you all. If you've got some family members who've had a horrendous situation where they've been falsely accused, they say they've been falsely accused, have they been able to perhaps sue or even identify those involved? Let's talk about it. We got to protect ourselves from those who are supposed to be serving and protecting us sometimes. We'll be right back after this quick break. You're listening to The Female Solution. I'm your host, Naima Latif, and along with my co-host, Sister Rashida Rafat. And we're going to come back and deal with falsely accused. What should you do if your legal defender doesn't defend you? We'll be right back with more with Leon Loving in just one moment, so stay with us.
There are people who choose to make a positive difference in the world. Our job is to bring you their stories to motivate you to do the same. Join us each week, host John Alexander and Naima Latif, as we bring you the educators, entertainers, elected officials, religious leaders, and community activists whose works are transforming this world. Find out how you can make a difference, too. Be inspired. Watch The Media Connection.
Hi, this is John Alexander.
And I'm Naima Latif. Meet people like you who are making a positive difference in the world.
Big difference.
Watch us every day on The Media Connection at www.youtube.com/TheMediaConnectionTV.
YouTube it. We'll see you soon.
We have an opportunity to transform the whole global society in the next 50 years. 50 years from now, the Earth will be populated by a new generation of adults, many of whom are yet unborn. Our mission is to nurture them in childhood with love, guidance, and protection, and to raise them in healthy, happy families. If we impart values of compassion, generosity, and respect for fellow human beings in the next generation of children, they will create a world where people can live together in peace. This is our goal. Be a part of the transformation. Get your copy of the book, The Female Solution. Go to www.naimalatif.com. That's www.naimalatif.com.
We're back. You're listening to The Female Solution. I'm your host, Naima Latif, and today we're joined by our co-hosting today, Sister Rashida Wafa, and our guest today is Mr. Leon Loving, who is host of the popular TV show, My Guest Ain't Guessing. Well, who would have guessed that Mr. Loving has had to endure a horrendous ordeal of being forced to confess to a crime he didn't commit, forced to confess to an armed robbery, and yet there was never a gun produced, but he still served time. It's more common than you think, and for those who believe it doesn't happen to good people, yes, it does. Here's a good person right here, professional person, all of those things, and yet this travesty of justice. Now, I want to ask you a good question because I know a lot of people who have seen the portrayals of prison, and usually it's the maximum security prisons that they show on these movies, killings going on. And your description, you know, it sounded like it was something at least tolerable and some level of dignity. So
right.
I assume that's the difference between the maximum and the minimum security prison.
Yeah, I was at a medium, and as I mentioned earlier, if prisons within themselves, all that they ever show or portray is the maximum security of Statesville, Pontiac, and Menard. If prisons were actually hard or rough as they, I don't know how it is now, but, you know, back then in 1985, I was in from 1985 to 1988, if they were really as bad as they portray, because they're actually called correctional centers, not prisons, if they were as hard and bad as they actually are portrayed, do you really think guys would be going back 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, sometimes up to 8 times? No. That's because, you know, as I said, where I was, Dixon, it was a cross between a country club and a college campus.
Well, that's one of the things that, matter of fact, Reverend Jesse Jackson was talking about this past Christmas when he was saying that there are so many people that are incarcerated simply because they can't afford bail, and a lot of people who are homeless will, in fact, commit a crime just so they can, you know, get some relief from the cold, because it is a place to stay, you know, 3 meals a day. It might not be the best tasting meals, but, you know, you're fed, and every now and then you might get a cellmate or whatever who is decent. And so it has become, he said, like a homeless shelter for a lot of people
who
just don't have the money to pay the bail. And what I found out is that, well, two things, and we've had some guests on that have talked about this. First of all, I found out that every inmate is covered by an insurance policy, so you actually become an asset of the state once you get incarcerated. And then for those who have investments in the prison, the more prisoners are in the prison, the higher the stock value is. So
correct.
All of these things provide a financial incentive for them to get people in the jail, in the prison, so they can make money. And it doesn't really seem to matter whether or not you're guilty or innocent. It just, you know, fill the jails with bodies of people. So why do you think
it's a numbers game.
And like you said, it's just us. Why do you think it is that, I mean, I'm sure this probably sounds like a dumb question, but just to really conceptualize, why is it that so many African Americans are targeted for imprisonment over and above the general population? Why is it that we are enabled to be jailed in such high numbers, in your opinion?
Well, as we mentioned, it's the numbers game. It's now called the new slavery. You know, you're incarcerated, and you're only, you know, as I mentioned, you either have to work or go to school, and you're only paid, $15 a month, depending on maybe you had a good job and you may earn about $20 or $25, $30, but basically you earn $15 a month. $15 a month to, you know, go to commissary. If you're fortunate, your family or friends will put money on the books for you to go to commissary, but basically you get $15 a month. So it's called the new slavery, industrial slavery, whereas, you know, it's a money game. As you mentioned, you know, you have those who invest in prisons, and as I also mentioned, at the time when I went, there were only about 9 prisons in the correctional centers in the state of Illinois. We had the, I call them the law and order governor, Judge Jim Thompson. By the time I finished my sentence, there were about 21 to 23 prisons in Illinois. So it's big business. It's always been that way. The racism and prejudice, well, it's largely disproportionate in terms of who's incarcerated. It's black, you know, the black population is incarcerated, and there are always miscarriages of justice with us, as in my particular case. And they say that by the time an individual, I think it reaches, 30 or 21, I can't recall the exact age, they have been, for the black male, they have been incarcerated. No, I think it's about around 21, has been incarcerated at least one time. Me, myself, okay.
That's frightening.
I was age 30 when I was incarcerated. No, when I was arrested, I think I was, with the trial going back and forth, I was around 32 or 33 when I actually was sent. I was a statistic right there because I was age 30 by the time I went, which, you know, as they said, I think it was like around age 21. By the age 21, you have been incarcerated at least one time. I, you know, went until I was 30. Also, you know, the fact that I was totally innocent, and also I was a professional black male.
So that kind of takes away the myth that it doesn't happen to professional men, and I think that's where a lot of people don't have sympathy. It's like, it only happens to those drug dealers, or, they probably did something wrong anyway. So, but here you are, you're a professional person, just having a difficulty, a medical difficulty, and yet you ended up.
Right, that's correct.
In jail.
I think when I was incarcerated, there were only about, I was one of about, where I was, about three professionals, about three, four, five professionals that was incarcerated. I recall there was a doctor who he murdered his wife, you know, through a crime of passion. He caught his wife cheating on him, you know, and he murdered her. There was a guy that was a Hispanic guy that was, he was a real estate. He had his own real estate business, and I had heard of a couple of other people, you know, with college degrees that had been there or recently been there or was someplace other that I hadn't met yet. But yeah, I heard about them. But you know, total of about four or five professionals or individuals with college degrees, you know, and you know, given as a Reverend Jeremiah Wright used to call it, there was an ongoing search to find the talented 10th among blacks, you know. So I also feel that I was part of the boom, boom, talented 10th that they were trying to incarcerate also. And the talented 10th does not necessarily have to be those who are professionals and those with college degrees, because as I, you know, it's my contention that, you know, they're trying to find the talented 10th, and they kind of are in error, are barking up the wrong tree, because as far as black folks go, We all are talented. It's not just a tenth of us. All of us are talented. You know what I mean? So there you have it.
Naima, I have a question for Mr. Loving.
Mr. Loving,
be respectful of and the subject that I'm about to ask you about. I know you had shared with us that you had attempted suicide while you were incarcerated. And
sure.
I wonder, just for myself, what percentage of people who are unjustly or falsely incarcerated under circumstances like yours and, you know, who, you know, are incarcerated after events like yours occur, and they see how or experience the court system or the judicial system and see how corrupt it is in many ways, and I guess they become hopeless and they, you know, attempt, you know, suicide like you do, and I know some have, you know, gone through with it. I wonder what percentage of people, you know, do that, you know, because they're so hopeless, you know, they don't think there is any chance that they will come from under these overwhelming negative circumstances to try to have their voice justly heard, you know, that they're really innocent and don't belong there. You know, I wonder if the suicide rate is high, you know, because we need to understand not just our small communities, you know, but, you know, as a country and internationally, when you treat people unjustly in this fashion, all the different kinds of impact it can have on people. And people have different breaking points and what they can take and what they can't take. And injustice, surely we have seen many examples of what injustice does to people. So I was just wondering if you had any feeling for the number of people that try to commit suicide because they, you know, feel that, oh, well, hey, I'm never going to get a chance. I'm just stuck here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't have any real statistics on that. However, I do know where I was in Dixon. There was a gentleman who actually committed suicide in that he jumped out in front of a truck and was hit and killed. Yeah, and
it was known that it was not an accident. He wasn't pushed. People saw him jump. It was known that his intention was end his life.
Right. Yeah, his intention, because he was very despondent. It was a well-known fact. He had mentioned that he wanted to commit suicide, and that's the way he committed suicide.
Now, for a lot of people who may not know also the whole sagging thing, and a lot of instances, there are suicide attempts, you know, by strangulation and so forth, so they don't
give belts
to prisoners, so their pants sag. And
they don't give belts or shoestrings.
Right, nothing that you could use to strangle yourself because, you know, as Razia just said, you know, it's a situation that would make you want to kill yourself, and there are a lot of people who would attempt if they had the means to do so. So that's kind of where that sagging style came from the prisons as well. It's the wearing pants that are too big, and you're not allowed to wear a belt. But in terms of some statistics, just for those who really want to get a visual image of the numbers, according to Bloomberg Businessweek, the section on global economics, it says the U.S. has the highest incarceration rate of any wealthy nation, with about 2.3 million people behind bars at any given moment. That's 730 out of every 100,000 versus just 154 for England and Wales. There are more people in U.S. prisons than are in the country's active military duty. That much is well known. And what's less well known, though, is that people who are incarcerated are excluded from most of the surveys by U.S. statistical agencies. So since young black men are disproportionately likely to be in jail or prison, the exclusion of penal institutions from statistics makes the job situation of young black men look better than it really is. You know, when they say, oh, well, the employment is up and so forth, they're not counting all those people that are in jail. Or when they tell us all these new improvements, well, they're not counting that large jail population, which is predominantly black males. And on the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2009, Becky Pettit, who's a professor of sociology at the University of Washington, said that there's hope that perhaps the U.S. is becoming a post-racial society. Well, you know, that quote has been requoted, and I think we know that it is not a post-racial society. This, as you said, it's still big business, and the numbers are growing. Well, we're going to take another quick break. Then we take a few callers on the line, and those who've been listening in, we certainly want to hear from you. If you're listening online, give us a call, 347-539-5639. Press 1 when you're ready to join our conversation. You're listening to The Female Solution. I'm your host, Naima Latif, and today we're joined by Sister Rashida Rafat, who's been our guest co-host with me today. Thank you for doing such an excellent job. And we've got Mr. Leon Loving, who has given us his story, his testimony of surviving a horrendous experience of being forced into a confession at gunpoint. It could happen to you. We'll be right back, and we'll talk more about being falsely accused. What should you do if your legal defender doesn't defend you? We'll be right back after this quick break, so stay with us.
We have an opportunity to transform the whole global society in the next 50 years. 50 years from now, the earth will be populated by a new generation of adults, many of whom are yet unborn. Our mission is to nurture them in childhood with love, guidance, and protection, and to raise them in healthy, happy families. If we impart values of compassion, generosity, and respect for fellow human beings in the next generation of children, they will create a world where people can live together in peace. This is our goal. Be a part of the transformation. Get your copy of the book, The Female Solution. Go to www.naimalatif.com. That's www.naimalatif.com.
We're back. You're listening to The Female Solution. I'm your host, Naim Latif, and we have with us today Mr. Leon Loving, who is host of the television show My Guest Ain't Guessing. And Leon, you've had some very interesting people on your show, but having come from a situation where you have seen corruption firsthand, what are some of the things you hope to do now as continuing your career as a communicator to be able to expose some of these things that you've seen and perhaps even at some point get justice for your own situation?
Okay, that question was brought up earlier. What have I done to bring about justice? As I mentioned earlier, and I'll repeat. First of all, I filed a complaint with the Illinois Attorney's Disciplinary Committee, which is a farce. It's the old boy system. They do not discipline their own. I filed a complaint with the Illinois Judicial Complaint Commission. That's a farce also. I filed an appeal. That was denied. I can't recall the judge that denied it, but he's a black judge. Sat on the Illinois Supreme Court. He recently passed, Naim, you may be able to help me, well-known black judge. He recently passed maybe 3 years ago. Can't think of his name. I guess I'm suppressing it because I was so angry with him. But he's a well-known popular judge that recently passed.
Eugene, wasn't Eugene Pinchem?
Oh. Eugene, there you go. You got it.
Eugene Pinchem? Yes.
Yes, he denied it big time. So after that was done, the only recourse I had was to do executive clemency. I did that. I basically, essentially, wrote my own executive clemency petition, which went before the Prison Review Board. And as you know, there's only a very, 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 out of all the hundreds, thousands of petitions that are filed each year, only a very small, maybe percentage, maybe 4, 5, 10. I'm sorry, 10 are considered and actually granted. You know that, and it's also looked at by the it's granted by the governor of Illinois. You know, I know I wrote a great petition because I consider myself a prolific writer. You know, my at the time my former wife, she wrote a letter. I got other professionals to write letters in support. You know, my wife, former wife, you know, currently is now the director of finance for Cook County, not Cook County Hospital, but the whole, you know, Cook County. So she was a great writer also. And other professionals wrote in support of my petition. But, you know, as I said, they only grant a small, very, you know, only a few per year. So I understand that I can, once again, I can file another petition for executive clemency, which I would do that. I'm going to do that.
Now, have you done any work with any of the civil rights organizations that have been fighting some of these injustice issues? I believe
actually, at the time of my incarceration, I notified the People's Court of Final Appeal, Reverend Oscar Walden Jr., who he himself has. You know Reverend Oscar Walden Jr.
Yes, I believe you've had him on your television show, haven't you?
No, I work on his show
as a
member of his crew. But anyway, he himself was accused of a rape of a white woman years ago, and he served 14 years for a crime he didn't do. So I'm in touch with them. I work with them. As a matter of fact, after I got out of prison, I served on the board of directors for that organization. And that's pretty much been the extent.
Yes, I know there's the Innocence Project here also.
They're
addressing a lot of people who had long sentences for crimes that they didn't commit, which what is happening is that now the state doesn't want to pay these millions of dollars, and so that's one of the difficulties in getting people to admit they did wrong. All you need is one person to admit that they did something incorrect or illegal in the handling of your case, and you've got a civil suit, and that means the government has to pay, and, you know, that's money coming out of the state treasury, and so there are many forces that coalesce to keep the truth from coming out so they can save that money in the civil law.
As you well know, what's his name, John Birch.
Yes.
Police, whatever, commander, whatever he was. During that time, got so many confessions by torturing black men.
Yes.
And he got it totally out of that, and he's only got a slap on the wrist. What was he incarcerated? He's incarcerated for something.
Some minor charge. I think it was perjury or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't
right,
for the torture.
Perjury.
So that's years. Like I said, slap on the wrist. But now, knowing that you have people who are armed, driving down the street, stopping, frisking people, and I know a lot of young men that are very apprehensive when they see police because they know that literally your life can be taken or destroyed in a matter of moments. And knowing that this kind of relationship exists, what would you advise people to tell their sons and their daughters even, because they've harassed and falsely accused
women
too. What would you tell people to tell their children and how to handle police and how to perhaps protect themselves from the corrupt police who could, in fact, try to push them into a confession? Is there a way at all to protect yourself from someone who probably shouldn't be wearing a badge or carrying a gun and given authority, but yet here you are person to person? Is there any advice that you could give them that may make them feel they have some kind of way to keep themselves safe?
You know, all I can say is be very cooperative, keep your hands in full view of the police, and be very cooperative. There are other places and organizations that tell you exactly what to do. There are books and organizations you can contact. What's my good buddy that's over the South Suburban NAACP. I can't really call the individual, but I did have both them on my show. Once again, as I say, you have to be very careful because, as I exaggerate, sort of like jokingly say, seems like the one of the requirements for the police nowadays is that you have to be blind in one eye and can't see out the other eye, to get on the force because, the individuals, in fact, shortly after I got out, a couple of years afterwards, I recall a young lady was shot by the police because they thought her cell phone was a gun.
I remember that. I remember that incident. Yeah. And
Naima?
Yes.
I have a question for Mr. Loving. Mr. Loving,
ma'am.
You probably have addressed this, and maybe I didn't hear it. But how did you do any follow-up in trying to go after the corrupt police officers, or do you have knowledge of what someone can do in that regard? I suspect that it's probably going to be pretty much like what happened with the attorney and your steps with that, and it's probably very disappointing, whatever they tell you to do. But anyway, I just wanted them to find out if you have knowledge of that or if you pursued that, these dirty police officers.
Okay. As I said, I filed an appeal. I wrote the executive clemency thing. It took a couple of years to hear back from the executive clemency. But, basically the statute of limitations, time has ran out.
Now,
what is the statute of limitations?
I don't know.
But here's the thing. Because I did, and it's kind of strange, did file an appeal. Had not I filed the appeal, which was denied, I would probably have more means of recourse. They say that once you file your appeal and it's denied, it's like
then that
they
close
over.
The case. Yes,
right. That kind
so
of
so is there a way you could approach it from another standpoint, such as a civil rights violation?
Excuse me. Perhaps.
I think that's a way that some people are possibly trying to go at it. But then, do you know what the status of those officers that were involved? Are they still on the force? Have they retired? Do you know if they're still out there functioning
as far as your land? I don't know.
But you still have their names on file, right?
Yeah, the original incident happened back in 1983.
Uh-huh.
So that's almost 30 years ago.
Yeah, so they may be retired, may be deceased, but yet.
I do know that the defendant, the person that charged me with the crime, there was a couple. The husband died. I won't say mysteriously, but anyway, he died. Mm-hmm. He died before the trial came up, so he was not in court. It was just his wife.
Mm.
Because he died.
That's odd. Yes. Well, we've got a caller. Let me bring in Brother L.A. from down south there, Florida. Yes, Brother L.A., go right ahead with Mr. Leon Loving with your question or comment.
Yeah, I have a comment. Just some pointers with because last year this time, I was in court, not criminal court, but it had criminal sanctions.
Mm.
And what I found out with my experience, which came later in the year, but anyway, when it comes to, like, reading your rights, what they call the Miranda rights, I think one thing that people need to realize or learn that you can flip the script on them, because you can the same thing you say to them and they say to you, you can say to them. You can interrogate the people that arrest you, but they don't tell you that when you're in that type of situation. Also, people need to learn that there are bundle of rights that you have if you do happen to get arrested. However, the other side, meaning the police officer, the DA's officer, even the judge, they're more than likely not going to tell you what rights you do have. Many times if you have even a court-appointed or paid attorney, they're not going to tell you what those rights are. And if you don't know your rights, you don't have any.
Right.
And now this is just my opinion. I don't think it's really so much a matter of race where we get disrespected. I think the big problem is we don't know the rules. And if you don't know the rules of your legal rights, how a court system works, how a police department works, how the DA office works, you know, you become a real easy target. Simply because you don't know. So I think that's probably, huh?
I just say ignorance of the law.
Right, exactly. And that's where we can be taken advantage of, or people, no matter what color you are taken advantage of. So people definitely need to learn the rules, because the system, which we pointed out, they're making money. It basically runs off of people not knowing the rules. You know.
I remember back in the 60s with the Black Panther Party, who studied law, and they named themselves a political party. They studied the law, and at that time, regular citizens had a right to carry weapons, open carry of weapons. And they would basically stop police officers who had stopped and were harassing citizens, and they had their guns drawn, which at the time their legal right, and they would begin reciting the law in terms of the officer's right to stop and search this person. You know, you cannot just stop people without probable cause and so forth and so on. And so they became an enemy of the police in a sense, because they were reciting the law to people, and they were standing there with their guns drawn, which was their legal right at that time. And so, well, of course, if you live in Chicago, you remember the horrendous raid on the Black Panther Party headquarters, in which two people were assassinated, Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, that were leaders of the movement here. But that really came about as a result of people being taken advantage of because they didn't know their legal rights, and it was to stop the intimidation of the police. But then we see the retaliation, like Mr. Loving has mentioned, you know, you have people who have within their power to kill you and cover it up, whether they plant a gun on you, whether they agree on a lie or whatever. So that being said, how does a person stand up for their rights, knowing that they may be facing somebody who is emotionally really not capable of handling being challenged, and somebody who could react violently and, you know, with that blue code of silence, keep it covered? Is there a way to stand up and be bold, be strong, and know your legal rights and state your legal rights and be protected from that kind of person who could just snap and shoot you and claim that you pulled a gun or something at them? How do we embolden people without that fear?
Okay, in my opinion, now this is just my opinion, I think we need to take it to the – I'm still saying learn the rules. But to take it to just one step further, and this is part of learning the rules of the game. The step further I'm talking about is organizing on a local neighborhood level special interest groups and political action committees, and attack the problem or problems on the front end. In other words, once you form your special interest groups and political action committees, I'm talking about local, where you know how the police department works, you know how the DA office works, you know how the court system works, you know how the aldermen's work and the mayor office works, and you attack the problem on the front end and get the rules changed or amended or adjusted or thrown out, then I think you'll see a paradigm change. Now, is that impossible? No, because just looking at the neighborhoods of Chicago, we're just talking about one city among thousands of cities in the United States, among the black neighborhoods in Chicago, they put a black man in the White House.
Yes, that is true.
So the same strategy that you used to put a black man in the White House can be duplicated to solve these issues in St. Louis, in D.C., Baltimore, Miami, you name the city. You attack it on the front end. And that's all part of learning the rules.
Well, you have to have a coalition of people who want to correct the wrongs. Because at first, you know, there are a lot of people who just believe that the reason why so many black people are in jail because, you know, that's who are the criminals. I mean, they believe that. And so, you know, the statistics we talked about earlier, I mean, some people are like, well, you know, you all steal, so what do you expect? So in order for us to change things, we have to highlight and expose situations like Leon Loving's, where a person who is minding their own business just happens to get stopped by dishonest police officers, and those kind are still being hired and still being paid by the government to serve and protect, and they're not. So I guess my question is, knowing that the system is a money-making system, knowing that it's money making money off of us, and knowing that those people who get their quota of arrest are helping the system, how do we form coalitions of people who love justice enough to stand up to the wrongness that's being perpetrated every day? How do we find people?
You had another guy, I forgot, I guess he was on maybe a couple of months ago, but basically, I mean, we can start with the people right here on air. Or go down where people just got out of jail or whatever, because there's enough people that have been through the system or in the system, and just, you don't need a whole bunch of people. You know, just get, everything starts with one. Everything starts with one. So, using the example of Jesus, you know, essentially he started with himself, and then he went, got one, and then he went to another city, maybe picked up two more. So you start with what you got, and there's plenty enough people. I mean, put it this way, there may be a million people that are locked up right now in the United States, or 2 million people, I don't know. But that's a demographic and a with a lot of political power behind it and money. If you just, on it once again, on a local level, get people, whether they're guilty or ignorant, innocent, that have been locked up and say, look, do you want to change the system or change the rules? Just organize that.
Well, according to the stats, 2.3 million people are behind bars. That's a whole lot of, did you say that's a large demographic?
That's a demographic.
Power.
And that's a lot of political power. But, you know, you just got to get organized. That's why I'm saying, if you just look at the black neighborhoods of Chicago, I don't know any black neighborhoods that are there are in Chicago, but, and I'm saying this because we got to get out of the victim mode, all right? If the black neighborhoods of Chicago put a man, a black man in an office, anything can be done.
Okay. That's true. This is Leon Loving speaking.
Yeah.
I agree with you that
what do you think about that?
Impossible situation to a degree. However, once again, I did work with the people to score the final appeal, which is a national, it's based in Chicago, it's a national organization. The mission of People Score the Final Appeal is that it's a organization dedicated to the vindication of the innocent. I was on the board of directors for many years on the People Score the Final Appeal. Reverend Oscar Walden Jr. is the founder and executive director. His saying is, support the People's Court of Final Appeal because you never know when and if it could happen to you. He also always talks about the fact that the reason to support it is also is that, but the difficulty that he faces with the organization is it's something that's very unpopular, and hard to get support because people, you got to change the mindset, and people just don't believe that there are innocent people out there. I mean, if you get arrested and incarcerated, people actually feel that you deserve to be incarcerated because you have committed some kind of crime and that the system is not corrupt.
I think that's the hardest part when people really have an outrageous situation like yours. Getting believed is the biggest hurdle.
Correct. Right, because, you know, once again, as I said, when I told people my story, you know, the first thing they said was, "What? The Chicago police did that to you?" You know, and, you know, they, and although it says on the side of their car, we serve and protect, you know, it's essentially boils down to we serve and protect our own selfish interests. You know, I really didn't get anybody to believe me until, you know, out in California with Rodney King. You know, that made national attention,
and
you know.
Right.
People didn't believe police do anything. They were kind of like blind to
the police
that
are always
are,
right. That's how they
right. You are taught, you know, back in grammar school, they'd have this little saying, commercial, like, call a friend, call the police. You remember that name?
Yeah, can't say that now. Remember Officer Friendly? Can't say that now either. Right, Rashida, you had a question?
I'll tell you something. I recall being about 5 or 6 years old, living in Cabrini Green, and I was walking on the grass, and a police, I was about 5 years, 5 or 6 years, police put a gun to me then for walking on the grass and made me pick up all the paper on the grass.
And they had no right to do that. But you're 5 years old. How do you stand up for rights at five? You do what you're told because you're scared, because you're a child.
Right. I never told my parents anyone about that, you know.
Wow.
Yeah,
Naima,
and that's how they get away. Yeah, Rashida, go right ahead. Yeah.
I have a quick question. If you haven't gone through that, Mr. Loving,
yes, ma'am.
Would you ever recommend to someone who is innocent of a crime to plea bargain? What's your idea, your thinking on plea bargaining?
I know it's
circumstantial, you know, from situation to situation, depending on what is, before you, but just in general, what would you think of that? Would you ever recommend someone who is innocent?
Okay,
and
I don't know a lot about plea bargaining.
Plea bargaining,
however,
okay.
I don't know a lot about it. However, I do know that it's probably a necessary evil, shall we say. And many times, the person is, they enter into it because they don't have the money. They
don't believe
that
they can. So they don't believe that they can beat it. Even if they're innocent, they don't believe that they can beat it based on, I guess, really what the lawyer tells them. Because the lawyer has to be able to say, well,
yes,
you know, we've got evidence we can beat this case. So if the lawyer says, well, hey, you know, you can't beat it, then I guess they feel like, well, I guess the best advice is a plea bargain. Well, there is a legal group that is investigating these large numbers of people that are pushed into plea bargaining because they're given the impression that they can't win. And and next week we're looking to have some representatives of that group on to maybe give some advice to people who find themselves in the situation where the lawyer is saying, well, it's better for you to plea bargain for a lesser sentence because you can't win even though you say you're innocent. There's a lot of that, and like we've all pointed out, it's a money system, so it really doesn't have anything to do with innocence.
Right, exactly. I've
got another call on the line I'm going to bring on briefly, and then I've got another question when it comes to why we seem to get picked on by corrupt police. But let me go to Minister Robert Floyd Plump. You're on with Mr. Leon Loving, who's host of My Guest Ain't Guessing, and, of course, we guess he's had to really overcome some very serious corruption. But give us your question or comment.
We are in your shalom. Who are we? Don't die, we multiply. As-salamu alaykum.
Wa alaykum
as-salam.
All right, Mr. Leon Levin, this is Minister Plump, and I have two quick questions, I guess. Want to know, are you anywhere what's familiar with Anthony Porter? And
are you willing to work with
Anthony Porter was also falsely accused and also was charged with a murder charge back in the day with John Burge, and he also was pardoned. And then they're trying to re-charge him for the same crime. And also, from your experience, do you believe that there is any justice in America for your particular case?
Okay.
Besides God and the people, you know what I mean? I know that
I'll always maintain that there is a higher justice. There's a higher justice, meaning God, you know. But Anthony Porter is his name. I've heard of that case, and I think he's working with the Innocent Project or some organization like that. Am I correct?
Yeah.
For the
Inner
City Youth and Adults Foundation at 4500 South Michigan. We're there every Sunday from 2:30 to 4:30, and hopefully you might reach out to him, and he might reach out to you, and do our establishing our collaboration. I heard the word mentioned. Coalition, which we are part of the struggle, the movement, and the coalition from Emmett Till up until, right down to the modern time, against the system, and the system is really against us all from our observation. And I can be reached there, and also hopefully you might consider calling me later, and we can connect. And I can be.
Well, I'll certainly pull your connection to you because you may be someone he may want to have on his TV show here in Chicago, and further expose some of the things that you've been working on. Well, we're about winding down now. Of course, I want to give you, Mr. Leon Loving, an opportunity to tell our listening audience about where they can go to see your show. Of course, we've got some of it airing on our TV channel, www.youtube.com/TheMediaConnectionTV. We've featured your show on Fathers and also an interview you did with Mr. John Alexander. And we're looking forward to seeing more of your shows. Now, are they available online regularly? I know they air here in Chicago on 19. Okay,
right.
we'll have to work that out.
No, it's not online regularly. Okay, quickly, though. Hello?
Yes.
My show airs on CAN TV here in Chicago, Chicago only, channels 19, 21, and 36, depending on the subject matter. It determines what channel it's on. My show, like most of the shows at CAN TV, is a non-series show, meaning it doesn't have a designated day of the week or time slot. Am I allowed to give my phone number out?
Oh, yes, definitely. If people want more information,
okay.
How may they reach you?
Right. I can be reached. I'm conveniently located at 708-208-1239. I will give you, give me a call. I will give you the time and dates of my shows. I will start putting my shows, times and dates for the month, post them on the internet. But you can give me a call and I will give you time and dates. Particularly you will want to catch in June, for Father's Day, I do a annual salute to fathers each year. This year's salute to fathers for Father's Day, the subtitle was Father's Impact on the Community.
Yeah.
I had a great panel. It's usually a panel discussion with three or four men. This year, ironically, it wasn't planned this way, but I had three ministers as well as a deacon on the show.
Yeah.
John Alexander being one of the individuals who co-hosts with you, Naima. And
yeah.
It was a great show. Great show. You were there.
Oh, yeah.
And,
fantastic.
First year I did the show, it was called Fathers, the Unsung Heroes. Second year was called Fathers, Our Parents, Too. So you want to tune in and catch my guest, Saint Justin. Give me a call, 708-208-1239. I look forward.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on The Female Solution.
Yes,
and you can get a bit of that fatherhood show at www.youtube.com/TheMediaConnectionTV. And we've got the 1.5-hour segment of it, and it definitely makes you realize the importance of fathers in our community. Well, I thank all of you all for listening in and joining in on this edition of The Female Solution. Of course, thanks to my guest, Mr. Leon Loving, host of My Guest and Guest, and as you said, you want to tune in for that. And thanks so much for my co-host, Sister Rashida Rafat. Thank you so much for being the vivacious and intellectual and interesting person that you are to carry on our show, and look forward to working with you again real soon.
Thank you so much for inviting me and having me.
And thanks to all of you all who have certainly helped to enlighten, and we really do need to fight for justice because it's too much of the time. It's just us. And join us again tomorrow. We're going to continue this discussion with more guests who have some stories to tell and some members of the legal community that are working with changing the system. But first, we must change the hearts of those who have misused their power and authority. That's our goal. Join us again tomorrow, 7 a.m. Central Standard Time. Of course, you can always reach me on my website at www.naimalatif.com. That's www.naimalatif.com. Go to our website, order our books, listen to our TV shows and our radio shows, and don't forget to get your copy of the book, The Female Solution. Until tomorrow at 7 a.m., may you all have a blessed day.
Women have the power to transform this world. We can end crime and violence if we all agree to do one thing: share. Let's share our wisdom, share our time, share our talents, share our finances, but most of all, let's share our love. This is The Female Solution. Join me, Naima Latif, every morning, 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Central Standard Time, as we bring you stimulating discussions about the issues affecting our lives. If you're listening online at www.blogtalkradio.com/the-female-solution, press the blue button that says follow and get our daily topics every morning directly to your email and your smartphone. Call in with your comments, 347-539-5639, and be a part of the solution.